Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Our country is experiencing a teenage mental health crisis. According to a new CDC study, from 2009 to 2021, the share of American high school students who say they feel persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness rose from 26% to 44%. The highest level of teenage sadness ever recorded. This finding is most pronounced among students who identify as LGBTQ, 76% of whom report persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness. But the big picture is the same across all categories. Almost every measure of mental health is getting worse for every teenage demographic. And it's happening all across the country, including right here in Kentucky. Stats like these motivate the series we've launched on youth mental health. We're working on this in partnership with Kentucky Youth Advocates, inviting KYA Executive Director Terry Brooks into the host chair here at Eastern Standard.
Joining Eastern Standard today is Lieutenant Governor Jacqueline Coleman. Lieutenant Governor, I know you have just an insane schedule, so we really appreciate you taking time to join us today to talk about Kentucky's kids.
Well, they are the most important thing. So we always got to make time for them. So thank you for having me. Yeah.
When we talk about children and young people's mental health, I'm not sure if there is anyone in the state who has the unique perspective that you have. I mean, first of all, you're a mom of children of a fairly wide age range. Secondly, you spent a little bit of time as a coach and an educator, so you know mental health from that angle. And now you find yourself as a senior policymaker for the whole Commonwealth. So you look at mental health for kids from so many angles. And I want to ask you a couple questions because of that diverse perspective. One is the role of the pandemic. Did that cause the current conditions? It simply exacerbated what was there, or a little bit of both?
I don't know that we will be able to talk about any kind of social, cultural, any kind of evolution without citing the impact of the pandemic in some way in the next several years. So I spent about 12 years in the classroom. I was also a basketball coach. I taught high school and was an assistant principal at the high school level. And so what I can tell you is before the pandemic, up until that point, we were starting to recognize a mental health crisis that was happening all around us. Now, we did our best to talk about it. And I don't really know that we did our best to do anything about it, but I also don't know that we knew what to do. And so I think the pandemic, in a way, has really exacerbated this set of issues that have lied right below the surface for so long that we've acknowledged, but we've claimed we don't have time to deal with, or we've got something else to do, or something else is more important. And I think the pandemic, quite frankly, taught us that there is nothing more important than our mental health and the mental health of our children, particularly. You know, they're dealing with missing out on what to us was a rite of passage, right? And I saw this in my own home. Let me say this, when I look at this and the impact of this, I knew on the political side, the government side, that we had to make decisions to keep people alive. That was where we were for a very long time until we had a vaccine and until we knew more. And everything else became a privilege. And so I watched as my adopted daughter, her team made it to the big dance in the NCAA for the first time ever, and they didn't get to play because of the pandemic. So there was kind of some unfinished business there. She did not get to have a college graduation. Will, my oldest bonus son, he did not get his senior year of high school or basketball. And when we had his graduation, it was one family at a time in the gym to take a picture. And then Will is a year younger than him. So his sophomore and junior years were impacted. And Evelyn was born a month before the pandemic started. So, you know, from everything from developmental delays with infants up to college graduates. That's what was going on in my house at the time. So, I paid attention. I kind of tried to gauge what was going on in their lives and really felt that one of the biggest things, again, that rite of passage was impacted because we were all isolated. We were all frustrated. We were all anxious. And we, for a very long time, had no idea where the end would be. So imagine your adult self, however old you were when this started, and put yourself in the shoes of a kindergartner or a 16-year-old or someone who's in college who's going to miss out on the last 2 years of the college experience. And you have to recognize that their lives are forever changed because of that. But we have an opportunity because this has given us a sense of urgency. This has opened our eyes. This has made us recognize that this is not something that can or should be swept under the rug. Our kids' mental health should be our number one priority. And I think if we respond in that way, it'll be all for the better. If we ignore it and fail to meet this moment, then shame on us.
One thing I want to dig into, because what you laid out, I want to think about how that applies to a specific setting. As you said, I think we all knew that where kids' emotional state was had lots to do with achievement, behavior, supports. Take us into the world of public schools today. What do you hope is happening in terms of schools, knowing they've got all that other stuff to do, like reading, writing, and arithmetic? But what do you hope is happening when it comes to kids and mental health in those schoolhouses throughout Kentucky?
Yeah, and I still have a connection there. In addition to having taught in high school for a while, my husband is actually a high school assistant principal. So I hear a lot of stories every day, as you can imagine, that you had when you were an assistant principal about what's going on. But what I hope is happening is I hope our schools are prioritizing their students' mental health. And I hope that they are given the leeway to do that from the powers that be. You know, it is really easy for us adults to talk about it and to use the lingo or the phrase that, that we hear a lot. But to dig in and to do the work, it's hard. It's messy. It's complicated and it's multifaceted. So I say that understanding that this is not an easy thing to do, but it's something that we absolutely have to do. But one of the things I really hope is that our schools are listening to our students, because if we're the ones doing all the talking, that's not going to cut it. Our kids, they have the lived experience. They have the answers. They are the experts. And when we talk about student mental health, if we fail to center student voice in reckoning with this challenge today, we're going to miss the mark because they have to be dead center of that conversation. And this is not something that we can talk at them about. This is something that we should sit down and close our mouths and listen to what they have to say and what they've experienced, because that tells us what we need to know and where we need to go.
As a historian, or at least a teacher of history, you're good at analyzing trend lines. One of the trend lines is that kids have become political footballs. When you look at the national landscape, we know that increasingly Kentucky policy is influenced by national direction. When we look at some other states, mental health has become politicized. And I'm worried that that just might be coming to Kentucky. Can you talk about the political dimensions of young people's mental health, how you see that playing out nationally, and potentially what that means to Kentucky?
That's such a great point. It's so hard to genuinely want to make progress and to help people and to fix this, and know that there are folks in positions of power that could make a significant difference, who instead choose to sit back and quote, culture war talking points because they think it might win them some political points at the expense of kids. That's a shame, and it needs to be called what it is. mental health does not discriminate based on any kind of demographic description, right? It affects us all. And as adults, we are called to put our bias aside. First of all, to recognize that we all have bias in some way and check ourselves, and to ask what's best for kids and to listen to our kids when we're talking through these challenges. But we have a real opportunity here not to take an issue that, by the way, is the number one concern for parents across the country when they were surveyed. The number one concern was their kids' mental health, and to fumble that football and to use these kids as political footballs, quite frankly. We have a great opportunity here. We've got the attention of the country. This is a focus at the national level, at the state level, at the local level. No one can tell you more than the people who work hand in hand with our kids every day how critical this is. It is our job to make sure that those people have every resource they need to do what they need to do to help our students. And so everything else should be pushed aside. I don't even know how you politicize something like this, especially not when you just listen to kids and take their direction and their lead on this. But to think about there being a group of kids out there that are being picked on by adults is hard enough, given all the mental health challenges that our students are facing right now. And we just have to do better. And we have to recognize that when we, you know, jump into our camps and dig in our heels and, you know, only repeat what we hear in our echo chambers, we're not going to get anywhere. And so it's just incumbent upon us to put that all aside and do what's right for kids, and not to try to find a political angle or to win points or to rile up a base. That's a waste of time.
So as we look at the 2024 session, both the budget as well as policy initiatives, what are some opportunities for both Bashir Coleman administration and the General Assembly to work together to make a difference for mental health for kids in Kentucky, not in 10 years, not in 5 years, but during the General Assembly in 2024?
Right. And that's what I hope happens. If I had one wish, it would be that, because it's so important. But I brought in a group of high school kids and we launched the Student Mental Health Initiative, completely led by our students. They held regional action summits with their peers. They facilitated conversations. They dove into that data and they crafted policy recommendations that we then presented to state agencies, community partners, and even the legislature. The Interim Joint Committee on Education got to hear these recommendations, and the federal government. And the federal government was so impressed with how we had centered student voice that they want them to go on a roadshow across the country to show other states how it's done. So, I mean, what a great compliment. The challenge is that we haven't gotten a lot of movement on those recommendations yet. And again, they came from the experts. And so, you know, we've got the recommendations, our student-led, completely student-driven, and we're not going to give up on them because we can't. But right now, in different ways, all three branches of government are addressing, dealing with, you know, looking into mental health in general. The legislature kind of tends to kind of gravitate towards school safety, and it kind of becomes a little bit different than specific mental health, but it's in the arena. And then the judicial branch is conducting town halls all across Kentucky. So we've got all these different perspectives. We've got all these people tuned in. We've got all three branches of government at least admitting that they agree that this is an issue. And so as we think about how we move forward, it's really important. And I say this as someone who, you know, had one new set of textbooks in my entire career of teaching. We got to put our money where our mouth is. If mental health is the number one issue for parents across the country, if it warrants the attention of the Supreme Court in Kentucky, and they are hosting town halls across the state, if the executive branch is prioritizing funding for professional development for teachers around mental health for students, then we've got to make sure that we are giving our schools the resources they need so that they can do what we need them to do. And actually, the students and I met with, when we met with the federal government, that has resulted in $40 million coming to Kentucky to help build the mental health workforce and to place those new folks they're going to graduate debt-free from college, and they're going to get placed in our schools, and they are going to deliver school-based mental health services. And this is the kind of change that we can look at and say that we're really investing in what we say is a priority, and we're putting our money where our mouth is. And so I would love to see all three branches continue to do that together as we move forward.
Lieutenant Governor, thanks so much for joining us today. For Eastern Standard, I'm Terry Brooks from Kentucky Youth Advocates.
With us now is a former member of the Department of Education Student Advisory Council, Spandana Pavaluri. She helped lead the Lieutenant Governor's mental health initiative that you heard about. Spandana graduated from DuPont Manual in Louisville last year and is now a freshman at Vanderbilt, but she remains an active senior advisor to the Kentucky Student Voices team. Thanks for joining us, Spandana.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to be here and talk about this work.
And first, if you could, help us understand the scope of the statewide youth mental health summits, workshops, and surveys that were aimed at better pinpointing mental health challenges, what the Lieutenant Governor talked about.
We kind of began these, I would say, over a year ago, and we were just talking to students. We started doing roundtables. We did some virtually, which had a lot of students attending, and then we also did some in person, and it was really powerful. We would each break off as student facilitators and have a group of students to talk to, and they were very raw and real and vulnerable conversations, and we did have a mental health professional in the room with us, but it was primarily student-led, and it was fully like a student conversation peer-to-peer, because we really just wanted it to be a safe and comfortable space where students could really feel like they could express themselves and connect with others that also maybe experienced similar things.
Some time has gone by since all of that work happened, and you've had time to digest it and think about it. What would you say were the key findings of the survey?
One was really just how students didn't feel like they had enough mental health supports, especially in their school buildings. We talked a lot about how students felt like they didn't have very strong counselor-to-student ratios, and that made it extremely difficult for students to feel connected or like they had an adult in the building that they could talk to and very much express themselves with. And I think another huge thing, and just a testament to this work, was the importance of student voice and how, you know, amongst COVID, when students were remote, it was very difficult to feel like students were influencing, you know, their school's decisions, and students were able to have their voice really represented and heard in their school buildings. A lot of students talked about how they would submit a Google form about, you know, maybe their wellness or something like that, and it would go into the void and never really be talked about again. And so those superficial forms of student voice really made students feel like their concerns and the things they were struggling with weren't as important and weren't as valued.
Well, Spandana, I know that you were involved in a very comprehensive COVID-19 study that got nearly 13,000 student responses from all over the state. And for this work, you enlisted adult research partners from the University of Kentucky and McGraw International to create the Coping with COVID Student-to-Student Survey. We've posted a summary of the study on our website, esweku.org, and it found that students were experiencing, and probably still are, significant behavioral and emotional changes due to COVID-19. What sorts of changes are we talking about?
I would say with the mental health aspect, students talked a lot about losing motivation, feeling very disconnected from their peers and from their teachers, which really led to feelings of isolation. And for a lot of students who maybe already struggled with their mental health or began to during the pandemic, it would lead to things like anxiety or depression. And we found that these mental health challenges were really exacerbated, especially for students of lower socioeconomic statuses who maybe had to take on more responsibilities or deal with parent losing employment, things like that during the pandemic. And so we saw an overall shift, and students felt like online learning, many of them felt like it was more of like a negative shift. And one of the huge things that came out of that was students really saying that we feel completely disconnected from school, because school was really stripped down to solely academics. When we think about that period, you know, you would attend a Google Meet and go on a meeting where no one had their cameras on, and you just listened to a lecture, and that was what life was. And so it really took away all those social connection aspects of school. It took away those teacher-student connections that are normally built in the school building. And one of the biggest things I found doing interviews and looking at survey responses was that some of the most powerful things to students were just those like key teachers, that teacher that asked them about how they were doing, the teacher that went beyond just the school and learning aspect. And that was really meaningful to students. So I think we did see a lot more isolation. I think we saw a lot less motivation, which made school and even some of those busy work assignments feel so monumental and feel so difficult to do.
Of those behaviors or those changes, do, and this, I'm just asking you for a personal observation here, but would you say that some of them linger?
I think it's difficult to say that there's not going to be effects from a period where, you know, we were basically just confined to our houses for like such a long time. And, you know, this idea of school that we're so used to, of, you know, going there and going in the halls and waving to your friends and sitting in class, doing group projects, laughing with people, all of that was taken away. And we were just alone. And, you know, we were, instead of sitting there with other people, we were sitting in our rooms looking at a computer screen for days and days and days. And I think there's always going to be effects from that. I think for a lot of students, you know, those feelings of anxiety or depression or loss of motivation or social isolation will always linger, because I think it's very difficult to have this idea of normalcy when everything around you completely changed for such a long period. I think it took a long time for schools to go back to even what they used to look like before, and they still never got there. You know, we lost the masks eventually. We did all in school eventually, but it still was never the same. And I think there's also lingering effects of learning loss, for example, that will always cause some sort of stress to students, because as they continue their education, it's really difficult to cover content from these periods of time when you were just completely put in a new environment and weren't able to learn as well. So I think that's also something that will still be distressing to students.
From some of the research that I've looked at, the way that teens spend time outside of school kind of fundamentally changed around 2012. By then, smartphones were ubiquitous. They were being used by most Americans at about the same time, around 2012. Time spent on social media began to soar. And in 2009, for example, only about half of teens used social media every day. In 2017, it was 85%. By 2022, 95% said they use some social media, about a third saying they use it constantly. And that's all according to poll data from the Pew Research Center. Do those findings resonate with what you know to be the case here in Kentucky, or where you are in Tennessee?
Yeah, I would say that sounds really accurate to me. You know, observing my own behaviors and just like noticing my peers around me, I would say social media is just such a constant part of our lives nowadays. It's something that, you know, I go on my phone and it's just, it's almost instant to like go send a text to a friend or go look at Instagram or go use some sort of social media app. And it's almost like secondhand nature. And I would say during COVID, I would say we really leaned into that, because we were just constantly trying to FaceTime people and trying to text people and, you know, use whatever means of communication we had, because we didn't have in person anymore. So that increase makes a lot of sense to me. And I think a lot of students leaned into social media and their devices more, because we really didn't have much else to keep us, you know, entertained and things like that. And I remember a lot of students talking about how during remote learning, you know, it was so easy to get distracted distracted and your phone was right there and your laptop was right there. And it was just so easy to access social media. So I would say it's still something that's very prevalent and seems like it's only, you know, increasing and increasing as even like younger students are starting to get social media. Cause I'm thinking like back in middle school, like I didn't have the same things that middle schoolers now do. And so it tends to go that way.
Well, I wonder about this too. Jean Twenge, she's a psychologist at San Diego State University. She studies generational trends, and she has noted a change in teen sleep patterns between, she says, 2010 and 2021. The percentage of 10th and 12th graders who slept 7 or fewer hours each night rose from a third to nearly one half. And keep in mind that kids in that age group need about 9 hours of sleep a night. Dr. Twenge says not getting enough sleep is a major risk factor for anxiety, depression, self-harm. During the summits and surveys that you helped lead, did you hear about a lack of sleep as being a problem?
I think student well-being was a huge, huge problem with what we, when we were talking to students. And sleep is obviously such a huge part of that. I think students really honestly felt like they just had a lot of responsibilities. And, you know, when we're thinking even today about what students have to deal with, you know, they have to balance school, they have to balance homework, extracurriculars, potentially home responsibilities. And then on top of all that, still find time to take care of yourself, still find time to, you know, do the things you need to is very, very difficult. And so I think a lot of students are never really taught, you know, self-care and how to build it into your routine. And I have always been a very like academically oriented student. And I would say sleep was something I heavily struggled with, and me and a lot of my peers struggled with, because, you know, by the time you came back from club meetings and then did your homework and then ate dinner, it was 11, 12 a.m. And then you would have to wake up at 6 a.m. the next morning. And it felt impossible to do well. And then also to take care of yourself. And I feel like a lot of students every night are faced with that, you know, that dilemma of, do I go to sleep and take care of my physical well-being? Or do I not do this assignment? And then it's going to hurt me mentally, and it's going to hurt my grades, and it's going to hurt things like college or things like that. So it's very, very difficult. And I feel like students are constantly put in these situations where they have to choose between their mental and physical well-being, or, you know, performing well in school or performing well in their extracurriculars and balancing all those responsibilities. And so it does become really difficult for students to prioritize sleep, I think.
Well, with all the change that was brought on by the pandemic, and that followed years and years and years of building pressure to go to college, to get a degree, to really perform, what would you say students in today's world need the most?
So one of the questions I really heavily worked on with the Coping with COVID study was actually an open response question about future plans. And so this was right in the wake of school closures. And we were talking to students about, you know, how they felt their like futures changing with the pandemic. And so many students just described feeling so uncertain, feeling like everything was up in the air. We had students talk about how their dream schools, they felt like they could never go to anymore because they just couldn't afford it. Or students who felt like they couldn't apply to the same scholarships because they didn't get to experience as much of the opportunities that they originally planned on doing. So a lot of students talked about, especially in the college aspect, like having more post-secondary support. I know a lot of our students talked about, you know, not even being able to contact their counselors, or they would email them and they wouldn't even get a response, or how the counselors, you know, there was one counselor for hundreds and hundreds of students, and it was just so difficult to connect with this person and be able to ask them those questions about, how do I decide what I'm going to do with the next 4 years of my life and the years after that? So I think having those supports in the school building is so important. And I think it's also a matter of equity, because when we think about, you know, post-secondary support, when we think about mental health supports, therapists cost thousands of dollars. college counselors cost thousands and thousands of dollars. And so it really, really negatively impacts all students to not have these supports, but it really hurts, you know, students of lower socioeconomic statuses or marginalized students, because they're not even able to access this in the first place. And so our schools are really this place that if we have these, you know, these professionals in the building, very accessible to students, and we're making that more available, I think it could really change how students view their education, how they view dealing with their own mental health. Because I think for students who struggle with their mental health, it's just really difficult because any adult in the building can often feel very like distant and like you don't really know them. But if these supports are really accessible to students, I think it could make sure that they know that help is there and help is close by. And, you know, whenever they need it, they could genuinely go to this individual and be talked to and be helped and assisted.
In the previous interview, Lieutenant Governor Coleman also said that adults should just stop talking and start listening. Would you agree with that?
My journey with student voice, it's really, I've had a full range. I feel like I used to be a student in school who really did just sit back and not really know the worth of my own voice. And I felt like I was inexperienced. And honestly, like to put it straight, I just felt like I wasn't qualified or was too, you know, young or and stupid to be even contributing to these conversations, which were typically adult led. And, you know, I started doing this work, and I remember, you know, every time I talked or every time I wanted to contribute something, I would always apologize before I said anything because I felt wrong for, you know, taking time and using my voice in these spaces. And now, you know, it did a full 180 of like, this was work that I eventually led, and students were the ones going to our superintendents and going in front of a completely adult-led legislature and telling them this is what we need and this is what students are saying. And I think that's been the big shift in this work, is really understanding that us as students, we may not have, you know, formal degrees and PhDs and things like that, but we do have expertise in our own student experience. No one else can tell you what it's like to be a student experiencing COVID better than a student who is experiencing COVID. And so I think that's often what gets lost in translation. It's not about, you know, adults not being qualified. It's just about the fact that students are also qualified. And we often don't really think about that or see that surface level. You know, I used to really feel like my youth was one of my biggest like limitations. And now I really see it as one of my biggest qualifications. And I think that's why we continuously need to lean towards asking students and letting students lead this work, because we're the only ones who know how to ask the questions that are going to be the most revealing, because we're the only ones that knows what it was like. So I think that's why, like Lieutenant Governor Coleman said, like, it's so important that we're letting students really do the talking, because there's just no one who's experienced it like we did.
Well, Spandana, you certainly do have a voice now, and we are listening, and we appreciate your time with us. Spandana Pavaluri is a senior advisor to the Kentucky Student Voices team. She's also a student at Vanderbilt. We thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being here.
Coming up after the break, reporter John Cheeves on Kentucky nursing home inspections.
3/4 of our nursing homes have gone at least 2 years or more without an annual inspection. We've become one of the worst states in the nation.
And a remarkable young composer brings his music to Central Kentucky Youth Orchestra's season opener.
I'm very much a people person, and I just love the aspect of creating a memorable human experience together.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events from Kentucky Humanities. On Thursday, November 9th, the Highlands Museum and Discovery Center in Ashland will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Abraham Lincoln, Attorney at Law. The show will start at 6 p.m. On Friday, November 10th, the Lexington Avenue Baptist Church in Danville will host Kentucky Chautauqua, Henry Clay, Divided We Stand. The program will begin at 12 p.m. And on Saturday, November 11th, the Russell County Library in Jamestown will host Kentucky Reads, The Bookwoman's Daughter, at 2 p.m. For more information on Kentucky Humanities programs, please visit kyhumanities.org. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
The headline reads, "Do they not care? Kentucky faces a huge backlog of nursing home inspections." It's one in a series of recent articles in the Lexington Herald Leader about nursing home conditions in Kentucky by government accountability reporter John Cheeves. He's here to walk us through the findings. Welcome back, John.
Well, thank you for having me back, Tom.
Now, there are several articles in your series on nursing homes, and today we're going to focus on the one that I just mentioned, in which you point out that lengthy delays between inspections mean scant oversight at long-term care facilities, typically owned by for-profit corporate chains and where many thousands of vulnerable Kentuckians live every day. Why is it important that nursing homes are regularly inspected?
Well, the federal government requires all of the states to do an annual survey of every nursing home within that state. It's called different things, a standard survey or a recertification survey. But the federal government has a financial interest. For the most part, it's Medicare and it's Medicaid, our tax dollars, that pay for the nursing home industry, many billions of dollars a year. And they have a financial interest in making sure that there aren't health and safety problems that make the quality of life miserable in these nursing homes, that hygiene is good, that medical care is good, that the food is good, that there's enough staff. So every year, the state health agency in Kentucky, it's the Health and Family Services Cabinet, is supposed to send an inspection team out led by registered nurses. And these are in-depth surveys. They're supposed to take several days, maybe up to a week. And they go from one end of the nursing home to the other. They pull patient files. They observe care being administered. They check the food. They talk to the residents' families. They interview staff privately. What's going on here? They observe it. And after several days, you get a pretty good idea what's really going on in the nursing home. Some of it's supposed to happen in the early morning or late evening hours or on weekends. And so you catch people off guard when there might not be all the staffing there's supposed to be. And a lot of the times, deficiencies are found, sometimes serious deficiencies that have to be addressed. Once in a great while, they discover stuff so serious the nursing home actually has to be closed down, although nobody likes to see that. So that's supposed to happen about once a year for every nursing home. Unfortunately, what I discovered is that about 3/4 of Kentucky nursing homes have gone at least 2 years, sometimes 3 years or more, between these so-called annual surveys. We have the second worst backlog of annual surveys in the entire country.
Mm. Your article features a graph that shows an enormous increase in 2021 in the percentage of nursing homes that were overdue for inspections, and that percentage had only slightly declined by the early part of this year. And we might think 2021, well, that was height of the pandemic, and I'm sure that was a factor, but are there other factors as well?
There are. There's two factors. One was definitely the COVID pandemic, because for about a year there in 2020, the federal government told the states, don't worry so much about the standard surveys right now. Worry about infections, because as we can all remember, for a while there, COVID was spreading like wildfire through the nursing homes. We had thousands of nursing home residents and employees getting infected and dying, and it was terrible. And so the state said, worry about infection control first and foremost. And so the surveys were sort of diverted toward infection control. And by the time in 2021, the federal government said, okay, everyone, get back on those annual surveys again. It's important. Get back on task. Every state had a backlog. Every state now, you had about a year's worth of, you know, catching up to do. And so it was a problem everywhere. Kentucky has had a much harder time catching up on that backlog than nearly any other state because we're losing nursing home inspectors. We're losing, for the most part, it's the registered nurses who form the backbone of these inspection teams. We don't pay very well in Kentucky state government. We don't have the kind of benefits, particularly retirement benefits, pensions that we used to have. We can't keep people. In almost any state agency, this is true everywhere from social workers to corrections officers to nursing home inspectors. And the registered nurses, they were until recently making about $50,000 a year. In the private sector, they often can make twice of that much money or more. And they were just leaving these jobs in droves for more lucrative salaries elsewhere.
Is it a problem on both sides of the staffing spectrum, a shortage of inspectors as well as shortage of nursing home staff, which can exacerbate these problems?
Very much so. Even prior to the COVID pandemic and even prior to the inspection backlog, Kentucky nursing homes were among the worst rated in the nation. 43% of them were getting below average or much below average ratings on their inspections. They had serious issues with quality of care for their patients. And the largest reason for that was they weren't well-staffed. There weren't enough, not just nurses, but even the certified nursing assistants, the people who don't necessarily have specialized medical training, but they do the direct care. They change the sheets. They change the clothes. They take care of people and bring them their food and their medicine and what. They respond to the emergency buttons. They were operating with nowhere near enough employees. In some cases, nursing homes complained, we're losing employees to the Arby's restaurant, the fast food restaurant down the street, which tells you what their compensation was for these jobs.
In your article, you note that the delays in inspections are eroding the accuracy of something called Nursing Home Compare. What is that and why is it important?
Nursing Home Compare is a website run by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And it's a critical website for those of us on the outside to determine how good is a nursing home. Many of us have had loved ones go through nursing homes. And there is a 5-star rating system, 5 stars being the best, 1 star being the worst. And you can rate any nursing home in your community, in your state, to determine how well it has been judged by recent inspections on everything from staffing to quality of medical care to even fire safety. Is the fire safety equipment? All of these criteria are sort of crunched together to give it overall ratings. And so if mom or grandma needs to go into a nursing home here in Lexington, Kentucky, you can plug in and say, hey, here are the 5-star facilities. These are the ones I want to put mom in. Or here are the 1 stars. Here are the ones I want to avoid. The problem when you're not inspecting nursing homes for 2 or 3 years or more is that that data gets way outdated. And so now Nursing Home Compare no longer is all that useful, because your information's years old. And one of the things you learn quickly about the nursing home industry is that these facilities turn over awfully fast. I mean, every few years, in some cases, a new company comes in, buys a bunch of the nursing homes from an old chain. Management turns over. Employees turn over. There's not a whole lot of longevity. And I can't tell you how often I've heard from someone who said, geez, I put my loved one in this great nursing home. Within 18 months to 24 months, the place had just, you know, gone to heck in a handbasket. And I don't know what happened. And it turned out a new owner had come in. Conversely, sometimes, you know, the reverse happens. Sometimes a bad place gets bought out and they turn it around. But, I mean, 2 or 3 year old information is useless information.
You shared your data with Toby Edelman, senior policy attorney with the Center for Medicare Advocacy in Washington. And it's her question, do they not care, that you quote in the headline of your article and in the article itself. If you would, tell us about her reaction to the information you provided.
Sure. Toby is a fierce advocate for nursing home residents, and she had sort of 2 layers of concern. One is that she found it appalling we had gotten this far behind, where, again, 3/4 of our nursing homes have gone at least 2 years or more without an annual inspection. We've become one of the worst states in the nation. But the other problem was, as I'd pointed out to her, I kept finding a number of nursing homes that already had some of the worst ratings in the state, had a series of serious abuse incidents, had terrible problems with poor hygiene, poor medical care, and they themselves had gone 2 or 3 years. There didn't seem to be any priority to paying special attention to them. And in particular, there was a nursing home called Hill Creek in Louisville that finally did get closed this summer. Among other problems, they had rats and mice on the facilities. They had a resident who got bitten by a rodent, and they had other very serious issues. I think we can all agree that nobody should have to live like this. And the federal government and the U.S. Justice Department went in there and closed it down. They had gone 41 months at Hill Creek between inspections. And prior to that, they'd already had a terrible reputation, a terrible history, and yet they went 41 months between inspections. And that was what Toby was talking about. She said, if you have to address a backlog, why aren't you at least prioritizing the Hill Creeks among your list? Why aren't you focusing on those particular nursing homes and at least making sure you get to those as fast as you can. No one should have to wait several years in a place like that before the inspectors come back.
Speaking of priorities, it's as though there's a 900-pound gorilla in the room in all of this, and that's human dignity.
It is. And one of the things that I find most concerning is the lack of concern for people in nursing homes. When I write these stories, I often feel like the people in state government don't care. The people in the legislature don't care. The readers don't seem to really follow the story. It's not a subject that seems to draw a whole lot of attention. And yet almost all of us, if we're lucky, are going to get old. Almost all of us have loved ones who are old, who have passed through healthcare institutions, whether it's a hospital or a nursing home. Certainly, this should be an important subject to every single one of us in Kentucky.
All right. That's Lexington Herald Leader Government Accountability Reporter John Cheeves. Thank you so much, John.
Thank you for having me.
Central Kentucky Youth Orchestras has something really interesting in the works for its 76th season opening concert, which is happening at the Singletary Center in Lexington on Sunday, November the 5th. It's a collaboration with Quinn Mason, a young Black American composer who joins us right now from Kansas City. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Quinn.
Hi, thank you.
And Quinn, your orchestral music has been commissioned and performed by over 160 professional, regional, community, and youth orchestras in the U.S. and Europe. In April, you debuted with the National Symphony Orchestra at the Kennedy Center, and you have served as the Houston Ballet Orchestra's youngest ever guest conductor. How did you get to these places so early in life? Give us some background on your musical journey.
Yeah, my journey starts at the age of 10. I started piano lessons, and at the age of 12, I started playing the cello. I no longer play the cello. But between the ages of 10 and 12, I discovered that composition was really where my voice was. And so I kind of worked on cultivating that skill for many, many years, and I had some great teachers and great mentors, and eventually led me to entering different contests and, you know, sometimes winning those contests, and that led me to, you know, get the taste of a composer's life, you know, working with performers, collaborating with different, you know, aspects of, you know, musical performance. And then I started getting these commissions, you know, people started asking me to write music and they started paying me really good to write music for them. And I primarily got commissions from orchestras because that's what I grew up around. I had mentors that were orchestral musicians, so I attended a lot of rehearsals and things like that. And so naturally my path was leading towards the orchestra, which is what I specialize in today. And I, you know, just wrote my music and I put it out there in the world, and people really liked what they heard and they wanted to hear more. And they really liked me too. They liked collaborating with me, and I'm very much a people person. And I just love the aspect of creating a memorable human experience together. So,
well, I identified you in the introduction as a Black American composer, but I wonder if that distinction is really important. Is your music influenced by Black American experience and culture, or would you prefer to be known simply as perhaps an American composer?
Yeah, I like the term American better. And everybody's different. Everybody has different backgrounds. There are some people who, you know, grew up in the church, and there are some people who didn't, and I didn't grow up in the church. And in fact, I like to tell people that my church was the concert hall, and I grew up in the concert hall. So my influences for my music that I end up, you know, writing are primarily American experiences, and I try to speak to the human experience as much as possible so that it's universal.
Well, tell us about Inspirations. That's the piece that will be performed here in Lexington.
That's still a new-ish baby of mine. I actually wrote it in January of this year. It was commissioned by the University of Texas at Arlington Symphony Orchestra and Dr. Cliff Evans, and they premiered it at the Texas Music Educators Conference in February. And it just kind of took off from there. It's one of those very upbeat concert openers that is designed to start off the concert in a good mood. And the title actually came last. I wrote the piece first, and the title came last. And the title came from an email that I sent to Cliff Evans. basically, you know, I was like, here's the piece. I don't have a title for it. Please let me know what you think about it. And he said, and he got back to me and he said that, you know, this piece is very much full of inspiration. I thought, aha, there it is.
Well, let's listen to a passage performed here by the University of Texas Arlington Symphony Orchestra. Passage from Inspiration, composed by our guest Quinn Mason and performed by the University of Texas Arlington Symphony Orchestra. Quinn, on Monday, November 6th, the day after the concert here in Lexington, you're going to visit SCAPA, CKYO's community program, Music Works, and give presentations to Lexington's music students as part of your residency. Do you hope to influence and encourage other young musicians to step up to the composer-conductor challenge?
Absolutely. First off, community engagement is something I'm extremely passionate about because I'm a product of it. When I was 10, I went on a class field trip to the Meyerson to see the Dallas Symphony Orchestra play Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf with Sting narrating. I still remember that quite well.
Wow.
And that's quite an impression made on a young man of 10, and it kind of just opened my ears to the world of the orchestra and made me fall in love with it. So nowadays, whenever I travel around the country, I always make sure to do some sort of community outreach, even if I have to volunteer my time and do it for free, because it's something that's extremely important to me, inspiring the next generation and, you know, letting them know that classical music is accessible and something for them. The concert hall is a place for them. And the Alexandria, the symphony, actually described it as me evangelizing on behalf of classical music and kind of having people follow me back into the concert hall. I mean, I seem to think about that, but, you know, it's mostly on the people who I lecture to make the conscious effort to come into the concert hall, letting them know that they're very welcome there.
It's the Central Kentucky Youth Orchestra's 76th season opening concert, Sunday, November the 5th at 5 p.m. at Singletary Center for the Arts on the campus of the University of Kentucky. The concert's a collaboration with composer Quinn Mason, and he has joined us from Kansas City. Thanks so much, Quinn.
Thank you for having me. Enjoy the concert.
Eastern Standard and WEKU are committed to supporting the arts in Kentucky, and that, of course, includes young musicians like those you'll hear when you experience the Central Kentucky Youth Orchestra. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more. And you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts, including Apple and Spotify. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.